I used to say that I would run because I felt alone or I'd be running away from things. And now I feel like I'm running towards things that bring me joy or make me happy. And it just kind of feels like freedom to me.
Welcome to Behind the Bite, where we delve deep into the real life struggles and triumphs surrounding food, body, and weight. I'm Dr. Christina Castagnini, a psychologist and certified eating disorder specialist, bringing you a unique blend of personal experience as a recovered individual with over 25 years of professional expertise. In each episode, we'll share the courageous journeys of individuals who have faced these challenges firsthand, alongside insights from dedicated professionals in the field. Whether you're seeking healing, inspiration, or simply a deeper understanding, this podcast is here to empower you on your own path to a better life. Join us as we explore stories of resilience, discuss the latest insights, and strive to foster a community of support and growth. Together, we can break down barriers, challenge stigma, and pave the way towards healing and living authentically. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to today's show. So there is something incredibly powerful about hearing from someone who has been to very dark places and can still say, hey, there is light on the other side of this. And in today's episode, I'm really honored to have our guest today. Always honored to have our guest. Honestly, I really am. I say this all the time. But in today's episode, Katie Kieslewski, she shares her story with such honesty, from the early roots of her eating disorder to years of anorexia and substance abuse, to the hope and determination that slowly carried her toward recovery. Today, we're going to talk about what it really means to lose yourself and then to find your way back. How, you know, recovery can really rebuild not just your behaviors, but also your identity, and why the small things you hear along the way can become the very things that save you later. This is really one of those raw, inspiring, and very powerful reminders that no matter how long you've struggled or how much maybe you give up hope or think that you're never going to recover, healing really is still possible. So, you know, if any of you out there are really struggling or feeling like it's just sometimes not worth continuing on in treatment or wondering if it's worth continuing on, just I really want you to sit back and listen to Katie today. Such an inspiring story. So again, very grateful for all my guests who come on and share their stories. I know it's really hard and it takes a lot of vulnerability, but anyway, sit back and take in everything she has to share. So I'll go get Katie now. All right. Well, Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity. I'm so grateful that you had me on as a guest, and I'm excited to share my story.
Well, I'm always excited. As anyone who's listening knows I am always excited and honored when somebody comes and wants to share their story, because that was one of the reasons I started the podcast. I really wanted people to come on so that anyone listening might feel less alone or hear something that a guest says that maybe they relate to, and maybe it'll help somebody else out. Because, and again, I'd love to hear your story, but I'm wondering for you if you'd ever heard anybody's story while you were going through your journey or your treatment or whatever was going on with you. And again, we can kind of get into that, but just kind of curious about that for you.
So I guess, yes, I heard some people's stories. I feel like later in recovery is when I started paying more attention or hearing more stories of recovery. But that's when I also realized how powerful they are, because we're all so individualized. Recovery is not one size fits all, and all of our stories are different. And what works for me might not work for someone else. But I do think that, one, there's so much power in a hopeful story, because it lets you know that it's not all darkness. Like, there's light at the end of it. Like, I always am like, look, if I can do it, you can do it too. Mm-hmm. But also, I think you can see, oh, well, she did this and he did that, or she did this. And you can try little things that maybe worked for other people, and then maybe something will work for you. So, but I always find, you know, a comeback story very empowering and very inspiring. So, I mean, I love to listen to them now. But I feel like when I was in the thick of it, not so much, but there's little bits that I will remember. Cause you know, when you're going through that hard time, sometimes it does feel daunting and it feels like, oh, I'm never going to get out unstuck. But then I'm like, feel like it takes one match to light a fire. And then it's like, boom, 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 boom. And all the little things that I had heard, like the little mantras or recovery sayings, they all kind of start clicking. And then I think that's when the real, like, it really starts, you see that snowball effect where just like the small steps build momentum. And then it's like, oh, wow, like, I can't believe I'm living this life today instead of, you know, where I was however many years ago.
Yeah, that's very well said. And maybe even you saying that will plant some seed in someone's head who's listening today, because it is interesting how you'll hear something and not even know it's the impact it's going to have later on. So to the point of why I'm so grateful that you're here. And, you know, that being said, I'd love to hear more about, you know, you from your own mouth, because, you know, obviously I could say some things, introduce you, but really you're the best person to do that and to, you know, share your story. So I'd love for you to do that if.
Thank you. Yes. So my name's Katie Kilischewski. I've been married to my husband for almost 11 years. I'm a mom of three. I have two girls and a boy, so they keep me fairly busy. I'm a big runner and endurance athlete, which I feel is kind of like a gift, because there was a time where I was unsure that I would ever be able to exercise in this capacity ever again. And for the past 4 years, I have been mentoring girls in eating disorder recovery, which is also very rewarding and something I love doing.
Gosh, that's amazing. Now I have more questions, but I'd love to get to, you know, obviously how you got to this point in life. So when did you start having struggles with, whether it was food or your body, or did you notice, like, what was the biggest struggle first for you?
So my eating disorder started when I was in elementary school. I remember being made fun of by some neighborhood kids because I was a little bit bigger than my friends. And I think that's the first time in my life the blinders kind of came off. I felt very insecure. My self-esteem kind of dropped. I just felt different. I think there's a part of me that's always had a little bit of anxiety and some perfectionism. And it was like everything started, I just hyper-focused on that, like, all at once. I remember, like, going home. I don't think I even really understood calories or anything like that. But then I started paying attention to everything. Like, I mean, it wasn't uncommon for women in my family, not really my mom. My parents have always been into exercise and fitness, but, you know, to hear what kind of diets they were on, or what they were eating or what they weren't eating. So then I started making changes. And then around that same time, I think I was about 10 years old, my pediatrician told me what I couldn't eat for lunch anymore. And then I was very into soccer. It was my favorite sport. All the way through high school, I played. My coach actually, first I got cut from a soccer team. He told me because I wasn't fast enough. So then I started running. And then I went out and made the team, and he had me racing slower girls on the soccer team. So I think all these kind of things, which I would never want done or said to my kids. And I don't think that my parents didn't have any idea, because I kind of kept everything in. I mean, things weren't talked about as much, I don't think, when I was younger. I kind of like just went with the flow. Just all kind of planted the seeds of my eating disorder to start growing. Then when I was about 14 is when I was diagnosed. Like, I remember I started paying attention to food. I started over-exercising. And then I started skipping meals in middle school. And then I was switched pediatricians. and I had to start logging my food, I guess, because I had been losing weight. And I remember going there and then my parents taking me to a therapist and I was diagnosed with anorexia.
Okay. So curious, when you were given that diagnosis, was that surprising to you, or like wondering like your reaction to that?
It was, because what I had thought I was doing to be healthy, mm-hmm. I had no idea what an eating disorder was. I didn't know it. I had anxiety. I had some depression. I didn't know what any of those things were. So I was felt kind of like clueless, but then at the same time, because I had already had these habits, so like worked in for years and years and years, it was very hard to break. And I ended up shortly after that going into my first inpatient facility.
Okay. So curious, like what were the habits that were the hardest for you to break? Because I know for most people, they do feel like, oh, these are just behaviors I'm engaging in. They're quote unquote healthy, or they're, I'm doing it for my sport, or I'm doing it for whatever reason. Maybe other people are doing it, or I'm seeing this and I'm following some thing I read or whatever it was. I'm just curious, like, what did you feel like, oh, wait, this is something that's good for me or something that's healthy and it's hard to stop?
With the food, it was more so restricting. Everyone was, and some are still, very anti-carb. And I was like low carb, salads all the time, eating barely anything, really comparing myself to my peers. Like, well, if she looks like this and she is this fast and she eats this, if I eat this, then I'll be, and it was like a never ending loop of calculations. And I did find eventually, the longer I did it, the worse it got. It was almost like, you know, like different, like a superstition, like step on a crack, break your mother's back. It was almost like, I like truly believed these things that I kind of like made up, had no scientific proof whatsoever, but like it was working for me. And it was just so hard to snap out of that cycle. It was almost as if my eating disorder was a separate personality and it was slowly taking me over to the point where I didn't really know who I was or what I liked or anything anymore.
Did you, I mean, looking back, can you see like other areas of your life that maybe you stopped in, like doing or engaging in, or other areas where it had a real negative effect?
I did. I withdrew from a lot of my friends, like my close childhood friends. And we had all, we grew up together, and then I also played soccer with them. So it was a big group of us that kind of played from when I was really young, all through high school. And as the years went on, eventually into like my senior year of high school, I barely had any contact with them at all. So I withdrew from people a lot. And I think, I mean, part of it was me. And then part of it, when I ended up being diagnosed with anorexia, not many people in my high school or in my area had an eating disorder. It was kind of unheard of. It was kind of foreign to people. Like they didn't see it. I kind of see it as an addiction. It's a mental illness. And it's really confusing for someone that doesn't understand it. They're just like, well, why can't you just eat? Like, why can't? And I mean, I am glad, like we were talking about before the show, that things are talked about more today, but I think back then, it was just really hard for people to comprehend.
So for people who maybe are wondering, like back then was when?
Back then. So I was in high school. I graduated in 2004. Okay. So probably, yeah, in the early 2000s, back then.
Yeah. Because, I mean, things have shifted as we were, you know.
They have.
Yeah, we've talked about that. Like, I've seen a big shift in terms of whether that's good or bad. We could get into that a little bit too, mm-hmm. but things have definitely shifted in terms of awareness and talking about eating disorders for sure. So,
yes. So, I go into my first inpatient facility. I ended up, so I kind of felt like I was this like I was a real rule follower. I was really quiet, obedient. And towards the end of that, because it's hard to go inpatient at any time. But when you're young and to be separated from your family for a couple months, even though they could come visit me, like it was, I'm in Baltimore. I was in Johns Hopkins, which is not far. It's probably like a 20-minute drive from my parents' house. So I was lucky enough to be able to see my family all the time. I felt so sad inside. And then I think towards the end, I started getting mad at the doctors because the eating disorder is all about control and you are losing that control. So eventually I blew. Like I was like, I'm done. Like it was like almost like the sweet Katie was gone. But then I didn't expect to go back. I just like wanted to get out of there. But whereas I was maybe like not all in with the eating disorder because I didn't know, like what I was saying when I was diagnosed, I didn't really know what it was. Now I felt like it had a hold of me, which was not that much longer from when I was first diagnosed. And it was much harder to give up. I think because I was forced into inpatient and not knowing what it is, like not having that choice, I've learned in recovery that you ultimately have to be the one that makes the choice to change, right? So forcing anyone to do anything when they're not ready, they're not going to change. So that's where I became a little bit rebellious for a while.
So you were in residential, and do you remember what it was that like got you out of residential? Was that like a voluntary thing? Were they discharging you? Like, because everybody has their own, I guess, reasons for getting out of residential, whether that's that you were better or...
No, eventually, I think I had hit my goal weight and I had completed the program all the way through and I was able to just continue with my therapist at that time. Okay. So I was released from Hopkins and then I ended up, I can't remember if it was during the summer or during school, because I ended up in total, I struggled with my eating disorder for about 16 years. So through that course, I was inpatient about 5 times. I ended up having to go back in the next year. I think I was in my junior year. So I was probably 16. And, during that time, it was like right at the end of the school year, I was dating a guy that was a senior. He got to go on senior week. So once I was discharged from the hospital, my mom let me go down to the beach for a couple of days. Our principal at the school found that out and he kicked me off the varsity soccer team. In the fall of next year, he told me I wasn't eligible to play. So that's where I mean, I think it's more helpful that people are talking about eating disorders and mental health now, because what started as just an eating disorder, it turned into terrible anxiety, terrible depression. In the beginning, I was afraid of drinking. By that time, I had started drinking. And once I had been not allowed to play soccer, the drinking went way up. And then that's when the substance abuse started coming into play and everything, it just got way worse.
Oh my gosh. Like that to me is just horrible. Like you get something that's like part of your life since childhood. That's where your social life, and it's like taken away from you. Like what on earth?
Right. So in my senior year, I couldn't play soccer. It kind of... Even though I don't agree with the principal's decision, it does kind of show you rock bottoms, right? Like the further you go, the more you start losing. So that's when I really started isolating, separating from my friends. My boyfriend and I eventually broke up, which was another it felt like a disaster. But I mean, as I've learned that, like, I didn't love myself, so I couldn't be in a relationship with anybody. So that's when, yeah, that's when everything started to feel pretty, pretty shaky.
Okay. So, I mean, that's not uncommon that, you know, trying to find other coping mechanisms or ways to numb out or escape or whatever purpose the eating disorder served, if you're not engaging in the eating disorder behaviors or it's not occupying so much of your mind, right? So as you're talking about that, do you feel like drinking like kind of became that for you at that time?
It did. I think that, I think initially I refused to drink because I liked being in control of my body. And then once I tried it, I realized that was the only thing that could help me turn my brain off. And so it became the only way that I would cope, which is one of the worst ways you can cope with anything. I ended up, you know, getting DUIs, getting in so much trouble. That's when it was super, super hard at home with my family. I have two brothers, because it was complete chaos. Like, I was either fully engaged in the eating disorder or I just wanted to shut my brain off.
Yeah. And it sounds like the more things that happened that were negative, the more right. you'd want to cope. And so the more you wanted to cope, the more negative things happened.
It's like the worst merry-go-round you could ever be on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine you at that time. Like, what kind of support were you getting? How were you feeling? Like, what was going on?
I had a few close friends from school, but again, so being that young, you don't really understand it. So they could just be there for me. Mostly, I depended on my parents, my brothers when we were like doing well. But other than that, it was mostly me, my parents, and my therapist. So then I did start to feel like it was, my time was filled with therapy if I wasn't, you know, in trouble for doing something stupid. And I mean, I did end up going to college. I went to college close by. But I mean, again, because I was really stuck in that same cycle for a long time, it took me 9 years to graduate with my bachelor's in psychology. And that's again why I was always in and out of inpatient units. I can remember getting so mad at my parents too at the time, like thinking like, why are you doing this to me? And now as a parent, like, I completely understand that they were just so scared. I mean, there's no rule book to parent. Like, probably overcoming the eating disorder and substance abuse is the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And parenting is right up there as a close second, because there's no book. There's no one tells you how to do anything. And everyone's different. But I mean, I do believe, even though that was a very challenging time for me, I do believe now that everything that happens to me happens for me. And it is a little bit, you know, just kind of crazy how you can kind of connect the dots to see almost like why all of this had to happen to get to here after you've been through it. So I do think that, I don't think that I ever lost hope that I would recover. Like, I sometimes say that I live in this fantasy world where I just always have had faith that everything was going to work out and be okay. Like, I always wanted to I wanted to be a mom more than anything in the world. And I wanted to have three kids. I wanted to get married and live where I wanted to live, or where I live today. And it's just amazing to me that the end of my story, that's how it all turned out. So I think even though I had to go through that to get to this, and it was really hard, I would do it again.
No, I mean, I think that hope piece,
maybe a little different, maybe a little bit differently. I could leave some things out, but I do think it's really important to never lose hope that things will work out in the end the way that they're supposed to work out.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of the reason why I'm so grateful that, you know, you're coming on sharing your story, because I think that, you know, maybe anyone listening can hear stories and hold on to that hope. Okay, no matter how bad it gets, no matter how bad it feels, still, if there's that little bit of hope in there that, like, okay, I can get better. I can get to the point where maybe this isn't ruling my life, or I'm not so sick. Like, hold on to that, because that is so important, right? Not losing that hope.
And I think as you go on, there's little tricks that you eventually like pick up or learn, or little things that I will say. Like, I do think that mindset has made a huge difference in my life and my recovery. And I'm like, oh, why couldn't I think like this when I was like back then? Why couldn't I? Like, I will tell my kids all the time, like, no, how you do anything is how you do everything. So like, if you are like making a decision to do something, you need to commit 100%. Like recovery, if you're 99% in, it's still not the same as being all in. Like, if you make the decision, like, I'm going to eat today. It doesn't have to be perfect. Like, you just do the best that you can, but you're making the decision to not give in to your eating disorder. And I can remember, I think as I went on, I became more comfortable sharing with people. I mean, you do kind of learn to embrace your vulnerability in different treatment centers and get used to talking about feelings and what you're going through. And I've learned that challenging the eating disorder voice has been super helpful. So even just saying to someone who's on your treatment team, oh, I don't feel like doing this, or I don't feel like eating lunch or something like that, like just getting that truth out so you're not keeping it inside is something that always helped me, because then you're not keeping that secret anymore. Just like, okay, somebody else knows, like, just get it out. Just get it out of me, so then they can help you. Or maybe you're opening a door that you had closed before. Like, maybe they're going to invite you over for dinner or something like that. So, I mean, I think that speaking your truth instead of keeping things so inside, like, we're afraid to say something, or we're afraid that some of the girls that I mentor, I'm like, if you don't know how to do something, ask a question. Or something's confusing to you, ask a question. Ask about, you know, your meal plan or meal prepping, or can you show me how to do this, or can you help me with this? Because these are things I didn't do. I kind of just like stayed quiet, went with the flow, didn't want to get in trouble or anything like that, even though I did. But you know what I mean? Like, I just didn't talk. I didn't ask as many questions as I think I should have.
I think that's so common, right? Like, many of the things you're saying, it's like there's so much shame, and, you know, I always say you're as sick as your secrets, and there is so much relief when you kind of open up and let that out. And maybe it's not as embarrassing or shameful, or you're not going to get as judged as you think. And there's just this relief of, oh, it's not just consuming you and staying in there. Mm-hmm. Right. But also it's just not sitting with it alone.
Right.
Right. Cause I find most people who struggle, like, they're people pleasers too. They don't want to burden anybody. They don't, you know, want to ask for help, very much just like, you know, I'll deal with this all by myself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was something you struggled with.
I work on the people pleasing still.
Okay.
Or like, I feel like I didn't learn how to set boundaries. I didn't really learn that. That's something I've been working on for the past like year and a half or so, just like being able to set a boundary with anybody, with your kids, with my parents, with anybody. It's not a bad thing to do, but I'm trying to teach my kids how to do that with friends, or if somebody says something that they don't like, just so then they don't like internalize it or feel like they're doing something for somebody else and not themselves. And I think that part of the gifts that recovery gives you that most people don't get a chance to do unless you go through something like this is before you recover, you're kind of like broken, right? So you have the chance to put yourself back together and you have the chance to do it the way that you want to do it. So you get to pick all the parts of you from before that you liked, and whatever you didn't like, you don't have to bring back into your life. Like, there were so many things I think I went along with doing that I was like, did I even like that? Like, my family used to go skiing every single year. I was so cold. I think I would like it if we just did a couple and then didn't. But I even had, my boyfriend went skiing, my parents got me skis and this boots and, you know, season passes. And like, I remember like thinking, like, I'm like, I don't even like skiing. I don't even like coming out here. I'm really, really cold all the time. Like, I'm just like, yeah. So yeah, let's leave skiing like over there. I'll do it with my kids if I have to, which I probably will have to do, but then they can see if they really like it. So there's a lot of things like that, that I just feel like I'm lucky to have been able to put myself back together and keep the things I want and leave what I don't.
That's really important, right? Yeah, I think, setting boundaries, even just being able to acknowledge, like, I don't like doing this, or I don't want this, right. Or this is how I feel. This is, mm-hmm. you know, not having to take care of everyone else's feelings. Like, I get to assert myself. It doesn't have to be like I'm imposing my feelings. I'm just saying what mine are. Those are hard things to do.
Mm-hmm. So I think in a way we're lucky to be able to do that. And we get to find out like who we really are through recovery.
And I don't know your experience either in life, but you know, a lot of people do feel like, oh, I'm too much, whatever that is, or my feelings are overwhelming me. If I express them, they're going to overwhelm other people, or, you know, so that's a lot of the reason people like hold them in and not, they don't share them or express them. And so
I think I've been told that I'm too much, and I have felt like that at times, but I think I've learned to embrace the intense too muchness of myself. I don't think that my life would be the same if I wasn't too much. I mean, I'm training for a half Ironman. So In previous years, I've done a handful of marathons and ultra marathon. My kids are downstairs. Usually 90% of my runs have to be done on the treadmill. It's the only way I can fit it in because I have three little kids. My oldest is 9 years old. Then I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. So I can't leave them and go run outside. And I just don't think that if I wasn't the way that I am, like them watching me like run every day, our life wouldn't be the same. It is like, it's almost like embracing the messiness, the chaos and everything like that. And it's kind of like, it makes me smile. Like, I'm doing my thing. They're running around like maniacs in our basement, but like we thrive on chaos. Like I kind of love it. It's kind of like one of my favorite things to do before everything went digital was like going out on Black Friday, you know, like the rush of that, like shopping with all the people out there, gotta get like whatever. I'd only go to like a couple of stores. But I don't know, just something about the thrill of that. It just always like kind of lights me up and makes me just smile. I think I like the too muchness.
Good. I mean, yeah, there's beauty in everybody. And like, just mm-hmm. to feel like you're too much just dims your light, right?
Right. Yeah. But I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'd rather be too much than quiet.
Yeah. I mean, but I think whatever that is, right? Like the too muchness, mm-hmm. I really believe that that's just, you know, really challenging yourself to think like, what is really too much? That's other people's maybe problem. Like other people can't handle emotions, or other people, that's other people right. telling you that versus like, are you really? Or is that just something beautiful about yourself where like you are more in tune with your emotions, or you're more empathic, or you feel things bigger? Like, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's beautiful and amazing, right? Like,
right. I have my therapist now. It's actually a really special relationship. He was, I've been through a lot of therapists. He had seen me when I was a teenager. He didn't treat the eating disorder, but he treated substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't see him once I started really engaging in the eating disorder again. Mm-hmm. But I've seen him. I started seeing him after I had my son. I thought I was going through some postpartum stuff. But he has always told me that I feel things deeply. So maybe that's the too much this. Like, I feel things very deeply. But he's always told me that's one of my greatest gifts. Like, aside from being up here, I cry a lot. Like, I'm very, very sensitive. And he told me this analogy. There are sandpaper people and cotton ball people, and cotton ball people kind of like soak everything in, and, you know, they just feel things deeper than sandpaper people that who are kind of like, you know, a bit more rough around the edges. And so I've always liked that analogy, just kind of like a big cotton ball.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I know we're getting to the end here, but I do have one question, and maybe some people might be thinking this as well. Like, and you had mentioned it too, like, you didn't think you could incorporate exercise to the degree that you're doing it now. And I know mm-hmm. that's a hard thing for a lot of people. And I've shared on the podcast my own history with running and things like that as well. It is a dicey thing, because a lot of times mm-hmm. exercise and eating disorders are very complicated together. Yes. Was there a time where that was a struggle for you in terms of knowing if your exercise was an eating disorder behavior, or like, was that always separate, or like, how do you navigate that now?
So I think I had left part of this out, and I forgot to mention, I co-authored a book this year where I wrote a chapter sharing my story. So if anyone would like I can send you an e-chapter, please reach out. I can either put it in the podcast notes, or if they shoot me a DM, I can send it to them. But the running became part of the eating disorder and was an addiction. I would have to do it. It was almost like I'd have to earn my food, but I also really liked running. It was just like a very abusive relationship, we'll call it. I eventually had to, I was sent the last inpatient facility I was sent to, I was sent to Florida for a little over 3 months, where I had to stop exercising. I did not think that I would ever be able to exercise again without counting calories. It took me a long time to get to where I am today, but I have found that, so I guess that I'll start by saying I didn't really exercise until after I felt that I was as recovered as I was going to be from my eating disorder. Once I ended up getting married and getting pregnant, I was pretty recovered, but when I found out I was going to have a baby, I thought, there's no way that I will pass any of this on to my kids. Mm-hmm. And that's what was kind of like, you know, how I talked about 99% in versus 100% in. Mm-hmm. It was a never for me will I engage in any of this behavior or these thoughts ever again. And I can't say that the thoughts go away like forever, because there's times where they can come back in different ways, but I think I've gotten a lot better at just shutting them down or shutting them up, or like I've said, saying something to somebody else, or, you know, realizing that they're not true. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really start being able to run again until after I had my daughter, which was in 2016. Mm-hmm. So I did take a long break from exercise. I didn't start running more competitively and training for races until 2023. I ended up having some complications from the eating disorder, which I'm still going through now. I have a little bit of osteopenia, so I have had stress fractures from running. So like I said, it was a hard thing to go through. So I still am constantly reminded of some of the damage that I did to my body. So it's taken me a long time to get to where I am today. I will say that learning to fuel my body for an endurance sport feels incredibly empowering to me. And it's almost like a miracle. Like, I never imagined that I would not be looking at calories while I'm working out and eating the way that I do and just feeling like I'm not an elite athlete, but feeling like I am running like an elite athlete or training like an elite athlete. It just feels very empowering to me. Mm-hmm. Like, strong.
Yeah.
Like, yes. I'm very strong. Yeah.
That's amazing. No, it's great, because like, I'm hearing it's like just that switch and realizing like, oh, I need to eat to fuel myself so that I can perform, right? Instead mm-hmm. of, oh, I'm trying to like earn my food through
or I'm like evening it all. Yeah, it doesn't feel that way at all. So I'm just incredibly grateful that I've been able to get to this place today. And that's why I do say sometimes that my story starts and ends with running, because it's been kind of beautiful to see how it's all kind of like worked out. And it just makes me happy. Like, I used to say that I would run because I felt alone, or I'd be running away from things. And now I feel like I'm running towards things that bring me joy or make me happy. And it just kind of feels like freedom to me.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that we touched on that, because I know that's oftentimes one of the hardest things is how to incorporate that.
Yet. And I will add that it's not something that I could do on my own. I do think that a coach is, you can't, there's so much that goes into it. I've used the coach multiple times for strength training, for running, for all different kinds of things. And I think that's the same thing as like the eating disorder recovery almost. Like, they lay out the plan for you. You have the food plan in front of you. Like, we become our own worst enemy when we try to do it on our own. Mm-hmm. So like, you are only hurting yourself if you don't listen to someone who I would consider an expert in the field, right? That's why we see a dietitian. That's why we see different specialists for different things. So, I mean, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a mental health professional. I'm not a dietitian. I have to ask somebody else, because I know where my thinking has got me before.
No, that's well said, right? I think, you know, it's hard sometimes. There are barriers to treatment for many people. And so even at that, it's, you know, there's many layers to this, to your point. Everybody's got their own path and journey. And, mm-hmm. But I think hearing your story, instilling the hope, knowing you can come out the other side and have a healthy relationship with yourself, with mm-hmm. food, with exercise, you know, it's very inspiring. So, and you're Thank doing you. This great work mentoring girls and, you know, that's great work. And can you talk about that just a little bit before we end? And then also, curious if you're open to people being able to reach out to you. So,
oh, of course. So when I was talking, after I had my son in 2022, so about 4 years ago, that's when I first decided I was going to start marathon training. And I said to my husband, like, I want to run a marathon. I just didn't feel challenged. And I felt like I was doing great. That's when I had my first stress fracture. About a week into being able to run, I fractured my tibia. Mm-hmm. And I was just like completely devastated. We had bought like a treadmill, and I was like, yes, I'm going to do this for myself. Because also, being a mom of three kids, you do, that's a totally separate issue, but you do kind of feel like you don't do what you want to do anymore. You're just taking care of your kids. So it was fun to set a goal and like a big goal. I ended up, after feeling sorry for myself for a while, became trained through a nonprofit called ANAD to mentor girls in recovery. And it became a very rewarding experience for me. I loved being able to feel like I was helping someone else by sharing my story. And I did that a couple times, shared my story publicly on Instagram. And then I had someone local who I knew, but you know, eating disorders touch everyone. And it's not like we go around saying like, I'm going through this, I'm going through that. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see someone that you love going through something that you went through. Mm-hmm. So I have been mentoring her for a few years now. She's doing amazing. It's also like a gift to see someone who's struggling come out on the other side. But I do think it's been really rewarding to feel like I'm part of someone's recovery team. There's things, and I don't know if anyone else had ever felt this way. I never minded going to therapy. I don't mind going to therapy and talking to therapists, but when you're dealing with something like an eating disorder, there is a little part of you that is sometimes like not trusting that the therapist is like, you know, knows exactly what you're talking about. Sometimes it's a little bit of a self-centered disease, and I always felt I could be a little bit childish where it's like, you don't understand, like, you don't know, you don't understand. So it's kind of nice to have someone who's been through it say, well, like, I kind of put them in the right direction. I'm like, well, they're right. But like, it's just nice to have someone who can also relate to you or just say, well, like, I felt that way too. And, you know, here's what helped me, like things like that. So it's good to feel like you're on someone else's support team, and it's very rewarding to see them come out the other side.
That's awesome. No, that's great. So again, if people do want to reach out to you or find you,
probably the easiest way is you can always contact me or shoot me a DM on Instagram. Okay. I'm at Katie Killie. It's KATIEKILI. And, yeah, if you just message me, I check them often. And like I said, I'm happy to pass along my chapter. It was a long story. I didn't get to part of it, but we touched on a lot of it. So thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Well, thank you. And thank you for all the help you're giving to people and being such a mentor. And yeah, like I said, I just really appreciate you being on here. And yeah, anybody, go on her Instagram. And again, thanks for all the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening today. Behind the Bite podcast is created by me, Dr. Christina Castanini, as part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network and produced by the Tweaky Tales. I love hearing from my listeners. So if you like the show, please like, rate, and subscribe to it on whatever platform you're on. And for anyone who wants to understand their relationship with food better, or who might be wondering if they have an eating disorder, I have a free 9-week e-course at my website. Just go to www.behindthebitepodcast.com to get your free e-course today. Please note, this podcast is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is given with the understanding that neither host, the publisher, or the guests are rendering legal, clinical, or other professional information. If you want or need a professional, you should find one to work with who can address your individual needs and situation.